For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle.
Hello,
guys. Kent. I'm showing my age. When I was a kid, if you watched TV, the difference between what was real and what wasn't real was really easy to take. I mean, if it was animated, it wasn't real. If it was a drama or something like that, they didn't have the special effects that they do today. They didn't have all these things that, you know, can make what's today a live action show look like what used to be a cartoon. The difference between reality and fantasy has become so blurred that, you know, the question I have from the philosophical side is, how do we know what's real?
Yeah, this is the time of year when you've got new television series coming out, you've got new movies coming out.
Love it.
And,
yeah.
You know, I tell you, the technology, the ability to...
CGI,
exactly, create entire new universes is out there, and it does. It does kind of make you, it makes you sometimes doubt your own senses, to be perfectly honest.
It's a feast for the imagination with these incredible special effects that the storylines, but the special effects, the way that technology can bring these things to life. Let me give you just an example that stands out to me, which is, in the one of the recent Star Wars movies, Rogue One.
Excellent movie.
Loved it. Yeah, fantastic. Great new kind of story arc there. But you may recall in that movie, one of the main, I would say not main character, but secondary character, a character we're all familiar with, who actually was like one of the lead commanders for the Empire. He had passed away prior to making Rogue One. But because Rogue One went back to, it was kind of a prequel because it's that little bit before where they steal the Death Star plans, they needed him to be alive, the actor, but he was dead. So they used computer. Remember that? They put him back in the story even though he had croaked.
Right.
And in real life.
Yeah. And
they did his face and his voice and everything, and this guy's dead.
Exactly. And they did something similar with Carrie Fisher. They took her and they de-aged her, basically.
They
put her.
They gave her a kind of makeover.
Right. Yeah. They put her back.
She looked fabulous.
Where she was the age that she was for the original
Star Wars.
Princess
Leia.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But at least she was still alive.
Right.
This guy, they had to bring the voice back and, you know, make a move. And, you know, it was. Because I didn't know what was going on when I first saw him. Like, I'm in the theater. I'm thinking, man, I think this guy already croaked. What's he doing in the show? And then and I was tempted to pull out my smartphone, but I'm too polite of an audience member to actually use my smartphone during the movie.
Right.
And but then, I was taken aback.
Yeah, and see, that I think is one of the keys, is they didn't succeed then. If you're wanting to pull out the smartphone, that whole idea of suspension of disbelief, of sucking you into their universe so completely that you bought
that I
into
didn't have
it.
Doubt.
Right, exactly.
But I did have doubt. I did have that because I had a little bit of prior knowledge. Plus, he did look, because I saw it a second time, is that good of a movie. I really zeroed in on him round two for me in the theater. And then you could begin to, as good as CGI is, it's not perfect. And so there was once you kind of know, you can see, you know, there's a little bit of blur, blah, blah, blah. But boy, that's a... But that really raised. If I hadn't grown up with Star Wars, I would have. I think I could have been hoodwinked by the whole thing had I not known, because it was that good of a presentation. I mean, it was darn close to being really real.
Right. And so that brings us to the topic of today's show a little bit. And that is the difference between, to a certain extent, illusion and reality, but also the question of how it is that we can truly believe.
Or can we?
Reality. Yeah. Or exactly, can we? The whole question of skepticism. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we can kind of dive in and talk a little bit more about skepticism.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
I'm Greek Orthodox and I'm moral and I follow all the rules and everything, but I wasn't, say, religious. So I started to listen to your radio station. There was something that happened. I don't know how to explain it, but I'm going to make donations to the local station to help.
You can help keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air by making a donation at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we are doubting. That is the topic. That is the topic of the show today. So, we started talking about illusion and the illusions that are created by movies, and it leads to that question of what it is that we can actually believe is real. How do we know that reality really is, and how do we, when we talk about suspending disbelief, what is it exactly that we're suspending? So this isn't a new question. This is one of those ancient, we're going back to the beginning in some ways. This is one of those ancient questions that philosophers started with way back when. I think Pyrrho is the first one that comes to mind that really, really addressed the question of skepticism and how it is that we can trust our senses and we can trust that we have an actual grasp of reality.
Yeah, and fundamentally, it's how can we reach certitude about what we know, or is the position of the skeptic or even radical skeptic a better one? And skepticism, to doubt, is deeply immersed in, I would say, the scientific method, right? The scientist. He or she has to begin with not only curiosity, but also a position of doubt. Otherwise, one would not seek to advance knowledge, right? If you think that everything's contained or it's all been answered, or you think there's more to it, you then engage in scientific inquiry, as an example. And so, since we're immersed in technology, immersed in science, I would say we're also immersed. That's not the only reason why, but I would say we're also immersed in a kind of skepticism about things, and especially when it comes to the sphere of morality.
Right, right. Yeah, skepticism, unfortunately, I think poisons the well when it comes to morality quite a bit. But a certain amount of skepticism is necessary. And, I think that's where, like I said, you go back to the beginning of philosophy, you look at Pyrrho and what he was saying, Pyrrhonian skepticism, I think, is where we kind of know the name of Pyrrho a little bit. What he was saying is the beginning of knowledge starts with doubting. You have to kind of sort through all the opinions. You have to sort through all of what you just take for granted. And you have to start by doubting it to be able to get to a point where you find some stability, you find something that you can say, certainly this is true. Now, Pyrrho kind of took that to an extreme, and he doubted his own senses. He doubted everything. And that can get a little silly sometimes. But, you need to have a certain amount of healthy skepticism to be able to come to knowledge.
Yes, I think, too, not to advance the timeline too rapidly, but the person who probably, when we bring up skepticism and doubt, I think in philosophical circles, one of the preeminent figures is going to be Rene Descartes.
Right.
Someone we frequently barbecue here on the show.
Right, right.
He's the troublemaker.
And you know what? Descartes, though, I think, what he was trying to do initially, and I guess it's a big question as to whether he succeeded or not, was going back to that same project of let's strip everything that we think we know and find some sort of sure foundation of something that we can know without a doubt. We can know with absolute certainty, and then we can build up the edifice of knowledge on top of that.
Yes, I think, as I understand his project there. Descartes was a very gifted mathematician, and mathematics, certain elements of mathematics can bring you quite a bit of certainty about things. It would be wrong, for example, to doubt that 2 + 2 = 4 once you understand the terms, right? That's not something we should be doubting. That's actually, we should recognize the truth of the statement and then hold fast to it. Well, so Descartes, I think, is looking around, right? He's living in the 16th century, and he's looking around and he's seeing there's a lot of flux all of a sudden, right? There's emerging science, there's discovery of the new world, the reformations are underway. So there's a lot of change in the air. And he wants to, like you said, Mark, I think he wants to, his project is to start anew with philosophical inquiry that will lead to the kind of certitude that a mathematical equation would give us. And so to start over, he decides the best thing to do is kind of throw everything out by assuming a radical, skeptical position as his starting point to kind of say, well, what if I doubt everything, peeling back, going deep, what's rock bottom? Where, if anywhere, can I start? How do I know I'm not dreaming? You know, is a question we still see played out. But I think that's where, beautifully in The Matrix, for example, the movie.
Right.
But I think that's where Descartes, that's how he starts. And then he does arrive at he does decide there is one place he can get footing. And where is it?
Well, that there's thinking going on. Really,
right.
When you look at the cogito ergo sum, it really is, there's thinking going on, therefore I know that I am. But, you know, it's interesting how he gets to that point, because Descartes wasn't just a mathematician. He was trained by Jesuits. He was very much a Jesuit. And I think
the wily Jesuits.
Yeah, I think people I think people lose track of sort of that almost religious background for Descartes, because what he does is he goes into a series of meditations to try to come to first principles from where he can build up his faith in reality, which when you think about the meditations of Ignatius Loyola, that's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to give us a firm footing for our faith from which we can then build up our faith off of that. So he follows very much the pattern that he learned, through his exposure to the Jesuits, etc. So yeah, he strips himself down to everything except for the very fact that he knows that because he's thinking, because there's thinking going on and there's thought, that must come from somewhere. And that therefore he knows that there's something that exists, thought exists, and therefore he knows that he exists.
All right. I love that. Cogito ergo sum. I think therefore I am is, listeners probably recognize or have heard that expression before. And that's sort of his launching point. But part of what Descartes, I would say maybe patrimony to us, though, is it also sets up, I would say, what becomes known as this mind-body dualism, which, again, becomes, I think, problematic because it's something that other philosophers will pick up on after him. And when you that means that the human being is mind and body, kind of two separate things that are working together. Versus a Catholic understanding would be that we have the human person is soul and body together, right, forming one person. So they're not two separate things per se. And so this division is going to lead to problems later on philosophically, as well as combined with that radical skepticism that he that's still with us today.
Right. And, you know, for Descartes, it was much more radical than just mind-body dualism when it comes to humanity. For him, the whole universe was divided into things right. of thought and things of material existence. And that really, I think, is kind of the root of skepticism when we get to modern times, that when we have this idea that you can radically doubt whether existence truly exists, which sounds like a silly idea, but when you start to think through it, you go, yeah, there may be something to that. But when you have that kind of radical doubt, that really comes from Descartes and Descartes' attempt to build an edifice on something that he knew certainly, and that was his own subjective existence. It really leads to a position where you kind of are led to almost have to doubt the existence of external reality.
Right, and I think that lays the foundation from which, or that puts us on a trajectory towards Immanuel Kant. And Kant, when you think about like Kant's epistemology simply means that science of knowing what we know, if anything. Kant is also going to, though, create a lot of problems for us in this field, I think, because for Kant, the mind never has direct access to the exterior world. The exterior world exists for Kant, right? But between us and the object is what he will describe as the noumena. And so there's a kind of, and that, okay, Kant is Marx's guy. So when I bring up Kant, he's already squirming in his seat. You can't see that, but he's getting ready to unleash on me. So with Kant, that's how I see it. I mean, that's how I read Kant. He's he's got an elaborate system, but basically there's something between me and the object,
right?
The noumena and the phenomena. And therefore, I don't ever have direct access to it. And again, I think, though, that Kant, here's my critique of him, because I like to barbecue Kant right after I barbecue Descartes and put them on the grill together. But I would say Kant then sort of traps us within our own mind, because he's going to say what? You can never know reality or anything outside of one's own mind. You can't get in another person's head. And there's something to that. I'll grant him that. It's an interesting thing. But he's still wrong.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You know, the noumenal realm for Kant is that whole realm of reality that exists outside of our head. And for Kant, once again, he does. He falls into that same radical skepticism that I think a lot of modern thinkers fall into. Now, the reason Kant falls into that is because he's reacting to David Hume and the writings of David Hume. And David Hume really is kind of the king of skepticism, the king of doubt when it comes to
Scottish Enlightenment. So
Kant is actually trying to address the problems that Hume presents him. And so what Kant does is he tries to at least salvage the idea that we can know with kind of certainty what we're experiencing through our own senses, that we're constructed in a way that allows us to have an understanding of reality that we can then communicate to one another, that we can then...
We have sense of space and time.
Right, space and time, and that is a universal principle that all of us share. It's not something that's completely subjective.
Right, we don't have to be taught to think in terms of space and spatial dimensions,
right,
or time. We're kind of those are it's a framework we're born with.
Right, know? Exactly. But yeah, he's trying to address really kind of a radical skepticism that came out of the philosophy of David Hume. And so we're coming up again to needing to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about David Hume, the skepticism that he presents, And how it is that we as Catholics honestly can kind of have a good grasp of reality and know that, you know, we don't really have to fall into this type of Humean skepticism.
And we'll be back to take a look at that right after this message. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Three things keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. One is our fervent desire to spread the gospel message. Two is your donations to the station. We couldn't survive without them. And three is underwriting from area businesses. Every month, these businesses make donations to the station. Please support them. Visit their stores, send them an email, or call them. Let them know that you appreciate their support of Catholic Radio. It's a great way to thank our underwriters for their very important support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell.
You think you're still Timothy O'Donnell.
I think I could.
How do you really know that you're still Timothy
Correct.
O'Donnell?
I am beginning to doubt it. In here with Mark Tuttle and our trusty sidekick, Kent Blanford. who's also our producer. Thank you, Ken, for being here. You make the show possible.
He's the master of illusion behind it.
Yes.
He's really the one that makes us seem like we're intelligent and know what we're talking about.
He does all the cleanup with his magical board over there to take out all the outtakes and mistakes that we make.
It's amazing what you can do with a little electronics.
Awesome. Well, today we've been talking about doubt, the position of skepticism and radical skepticism. We've brought up a few different philosophers over time. And right before the break, Mark, you had brought up, he's a giant, really, in philosophy, David Hume, who was a Scotsman, right? And quite a troublemaker, I would say, and an incredibly interesting fellow. Tell us a little bit about David Hume. What makes him interesting or relevant to at least the topic of skepticism?
Right. Yeah. David Hume, like I said, he's kind of the king of skepticism because he really led to skeptical doubt of two important processes that goes on in our minds every day. We can't really live without these two processes. And yet David Hume sort of doubted their validity. So the two big things that David Hume led us to doubt through his philosophy were the process of induction, which when you think of science is based on the idea of being able to induce from a series of prior propositions that, you know, we can know with certainty that certain things logically follow. David Hume doubted that process.
Yep.
And the second thing is causation, that you cannot necessarily know that just because you see one thing, that the second thing that follows was necessarily caused by that. And once again, that's a process that, every day we go through everyday life with inductive and believing in causation. You know, these are parts of life that we couldn't really exist without, and yet David Hume was doubting their validity.
I think the one quick example maybe to share to illustrate those points would be he was said to, you know, to doubt. He would say it's rational to doubt that the sun would come up tomorrow because there's no guarantee.
Right.
Right. Now all of us though we're going to make our way through today, relying, counting on the predictability that the sun is going to set and then it's going to rise, you know, and, you know, wash, rinse, repeat, right? But for Hume, he would say, I have no good reason to assert the claim or hang on to the claim that, you know, tomorrow is going to come.
Right. Yeah. The idea that the sun is going to rise tomorrow is just a belief that we have that's based off of prior experience. And so it's just sort of this habitual thing that we believe that things that have happened in the past are going to happen in the future, but we really have no reason to know with certainty that the sun is going to rise tomorrow.
Right. I mean, he might say something like, well, gee, Mark, how do you know the sun's not going to just explode tomorrow?
Right.
You know, it sounds kind of juvenile, actually. You know, it sounds like something like a couple of 12-year-olds.
Right.
You know, we might say to each other.
Right. And so, you know, we brought up David Kant we brought up Immanuel Kant.
You just hylomorphed them together.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But we brought up
that's a chimera. We'll get Dr. Ebel back to talk about how he.
But Kant's approach to this was to kind of acknowledge that you know what actually happens out in reality, we can't know with certainty, but we can have a good sense that we're sort of wired this way. This is the way our brains are made, to be able to intuit causation and to intuit induction. And since our brains are made that way, then we can kind of talk, but we don't really have any access to knowing if the world actually works that way. And so David Hume's right to the extent that we're taking it on faith that the world's made that way. But we can know with a certain amount of certainty that's how we perceive things and how we know things.
Here's some of the trouble I think that Hume causes us. He's especially, again, spilling over into this area of morality and ethics. Hume, as I've read him and come to understand him, will posit that everything is really reducible. When it comes to like human interactions, everything's reducible to custom. Right. Now, think about that. There's an attraction to that. In other words, there are not any, say, universal moral laws. Rather, Hume would say, if you look around, you know, different people, different communities, different societies, in different parts of the world, different time periods, all have their own set of understandings around, you know, what's right and wrong, the good and the bad, and therefore everything really is reducible to its custom. It's just sort of your habits that are handed on. Just, you know, you decorate your Christmas tree one way, Mark, at your house, and I decorate mine differently because, you know, this is kind of our family's customer tradition. And so Hume's philosophy really undercuts objective moral standards.
Right. Yeah. All Hume is really left to go on as far as building any sense of a morality is an idea of sense. You know, that you know, we have a certain moral sense about us, and things either, you know,
a kind of intuition
repel us, yeah, or they draw us in. But, you know, really morality is based on sentiment and sense. It's just a way that it makes us feel. So when we say something's morally wrong, what we're really saying is that makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable in a moral sense.
Yeah, or mildly uncomfortable, right, somewhere in that range. No, or I just don't approve of it. You know, I think it's wrong, but who am I to judge?
Right. Now, I will give David Hume some credit that, you know, after David...
We have to go to a break, Mark.
Yeah. No. You know, we
started... I'm just getting out the KC masterpiece for Hume. I'm just starting to barbecue him. You're going to bail him out.
I'm going to bail him out. Talk
all
about
right,
some
right,
redeeming
go
qualities.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Fair and balanced, Mark.
But, you know, we talked about Descartes, and we talked about this gigantic split that he created with trying to base everything on the edifice of subjective existence. So yeah, all he could know is what's in his own head. And Hume, of course, kind of takes that a little bit further into a radical skepticism. But Hume does try to solve some moral problems that was created by Descartes by drawing us back to a sense of virtue ethics. So, and we've talked a lot about virtue ethics. Virtue ethics is really the ethical system of the church in a lot of ways. You know, the when the church talks about morality, it's based off of St. Thomas's writings, which are, you know, interpretations of Aristotle. And it leads us to looking more at the idea of what makes us virtuous, what makes us into saints, what makes us holy in the end, and less off of a set of legal prescriptions of right and wrong, you know, that are standard, you know, laws that have been given down from on high. That's really more of a modern idea. And the way the church thinks about morality is more in terms of virtue ethics.
Yeah, I would say that's where she will place her emphasis. At the same time, though, we are given moral laws and
sure,
commands, and we're not free to dispense with them at all. But it's sort of, I kind of sometimes think of it as more of like the, you know, what's the minimum or what are the requirements versus what's going to actually lead us to happiness, human flourishing, or even more importantly, maybe what's our final end?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
What's, you know, how do we get to heaven?
Right. Well, the moral laws that are out there, I think, work more like crib rails. You know, if you got a little baby and you take the baby and you put them in a crib, they're safe. It's a secure place because why? They're in a place where there are boundaries that they can't go beyond and get themselves into trouble. But, you know, within those boundaries, they need to grow. They need to develop. So you put toys in there and you put things to help them kind of grow into the people that they need to be. And so, you know, a lot of the church's teaching on morality is that attempt to help us to grow and to flourish and to become into the saints that God created us to be. But at the same time, there are some definite barriers that are set there that kind of keep us safe and keep us from getting into trouble.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think of like the Decalogue, right, the Ten Commandments, and the Beatitudes, right, from the Sermon on the Mount, St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5-7, and how the Decalogue, it, like you said, kind of sets these firm. It's a universal moral code or moral law that's inviolable, but at the same time, we're called beyond that, right, to what. The happiness of the Beatitudes and living out the Beatitudes. So they're not one or the other, but rather it's both and it's the Beatitudes that help us transcend, right, the moral law. And sometimes I'll use a quick analogy, a sports analogy, believe it or not. So I'll point to growing up, I loved watching Michael Jordan, you know, play basketball, especially in the 90s, the Bulls. I mean,
yeah, I know a lot of people want to argue that LeBron James is the greatest player ever, but you watch clips, you watch videos of Michael Jordan playing, and honestly, in my opinion, there's no comparison.
I'm skeptical about that. But.
Right, exactly. And what I point to, though, sometimes I'll use this in class, what I'll point to is I say, you know what makes Michael, this idea of rule following versus transcending the rules. I'll say, well, here's the thing. You know, if you look at Michael Jordan as a basketball player, it's not that he violated or dispensed with the rules of basketball, right? No, he followed them.
Right.
But when he took the court, he not only followed them, he transcended or rose above them. And that's how I think we can understand our role, how the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, work with the Beatitudes.
Right. Well, I will just point this out just to annoy you, Tim, that what you just described there is Kant's theory of aesthetic genius. Right there. You know,
I'm a genius. Thank you, Mark. I knew I'd get you to admit to it.
You know, you can't avoid it.
You're, and aesthetic, meaning I'm a beautiful genius.
Right, right.
Thank you.
But
last.
You seem to stumble into admitting that Kant was right.
Even a blind squirrel, Mark. Even a blind squirrel will find an acorn right. From time to time.
Well,
I keep looking.
Right, exactly. Well, I also tried to throw a little bone Hume's way. But the fact of the matter is Hume's philosophy still remains very, very problematic. He may have drawn us a little bit closer to the idea of virtue ethics, but there was still a radical skepticism there as far as moral belief.
Yeah, it was very dangerous to be an out of the closet atheist at his time, but he was, I guess in circles, privately speaking, he had a reputation for being an atheist. I think that was the justification why he was never really offered a professorship at university, despite his prominence as a thinker and a writer. And I think atheism, quite frankly, is a huge impediment. I mean, it's not. I mean, to be an atheist is to be holding to an incredibly you're on the wrong side of an incredibly important question, maybe the most important question, whether God exists or not, and it has implications. It's going to cloud. And for some, even pollute everything that follows from that. And I look at like a Christopher Hitchens, right? One of the four horsemen of atheism. I know it's taking us a little far afield, but Hitchens also was a pretty big skeptic, a very gifted speaker and writer, willing to debate, which I always appreciated about him. But he too, I think that the atheism ultimately, in my estimation, was a kind of toxin in his. Intellectual biography that polluted his lifelong efforts of writing and speaking.
Yeah, and I think with Hume, there's both a cause and effect when it comes to the atheism there, because I think his skeptical his position of skepticism of doubting induction and doubting causation, I think in a lot of ways leads or reinforces. His atheistic beliefs, but I also think it's rooted to a certain extent in a rejection of sort of the traditional logic and traditional psychology that was part of church teaching and still is today, mm-hmm. that came from the writings of St. Thomas. So the answer to Hume's skepticism really lies back in the scholastic tradition that Descartes kind of shed off, and then Hume sort of inherited a position of having discarded in the past.
Well, that's an excellent point. That gives us a great opportunity to bring in a contemporary Catholic philosopher that we both hold in high esteem, Dr. Edward Faeser, F-E-S-E-R. So I know you recently read an article that he posted on his blog, which is his blog's excellent. It really
it
is.
It is. Yeah, it's.
But he touches on this, doesn't
he? Yeah,
he
does. He's written a series of blog posts on Hume. One of the most recent ones was on miracles, and sort of Hume takes a position of radical doubt of the idea of miracles. And,
right, he doesn't think they happen.
Right, exactly. And he thinks, the rational position is to be skeptical for any claim of a miracle. As the blog post kind of points out, you know, that position of radical doubt depends a lot on what you can take for granted from the intellectual sort of culture and your intellectual formation. If you can take a lot of things that have been built up and shown to be true, then the idea of a miracle reinforces that. It doesn't necessarily, you know, stand outside of reality. It's part of reality, and therefore, you know, you might want to take them seriously and consider them. But, you know, I highly recommend Dr. Edward Faser's blog for these. But, you know, he also does describe a little bit about Hume's doubt on induction and causation and where that comes from. But more importantly, he points back in the direction, once again, of St. Thomas and how the traditional logic of the church really sort of diffuses the skepticism. And he kind of shows a little bit of where Hume might have gone wrong.
Well, and I also think, so Dr. Faser is well eminently worth reading. He has a book on epistemology too, but he's got probably a dozen books now. And what I like about what Dr. Faser's been up to is he's really tried to represent the rigorous scholastic philosophy of the medieval period in a way that the Enlightenment and modernity, you know, threw it aside as, you know, stale junk. And it's quite the opposite when it's done really well, like Dr. Faser can do it. I mean, it's formidable when you read his writing. I mean,
right? Yeah.
He takes reason and argumentation to a whole new level.
You know, his an entree for Dr. Faser would be his book, The Last Superstition. I think that's kind of where you want to start with.
Yeah, which is his book on atheism.
It's his book where he barbecues all these guys you like to barbecue, Tim.
Exactly. Just remember, Mark, I'm a beautiful genius. That's what you called me.
Well, let's get back a little bit to David Hume here for a second. So David Hume has this position of radical skepticism, but where that's rooted, and like I said, I've got to credit Dr. Faser for pointing this out, is really an impoverishment of the idea of ideas, the concept of what a concept is. So I was just teaching a logic class to high school students, and we talked a little bit about this process of simple apprehension, where when we see something, we take the mental image that creates. So we get all the information from our sense perception. In our imagination, we put together a mental image.
Most importantly, our sight.
Our sight, exactly. Yeah. And then we abstract from that the idea of a concept or a universal, so that it's not just this table or this chair or this person that I'm seeing in front of me. We have the conceptual apparatus from that to kind of understand what it is we're seeing.
Yeah, I'd like to use the example along those lines, this idea of abstraction, you know, that we pull out our minds through that process of apprehension. Our minds will naturally look for and separate out non-essential qualities. So to get at what the thing essentially is, it's what's its essential nature or its substantial form. And I like to use the example of dogs because I'm a dog lover and I got a couple of dogs at home right now. And think about, like, if you had a little niece or nephew or son or daughter, and you're trying to, it's 2 or 3 years old or so, and you want to teach them about animals, different kinds of animals. And so you're with your niece, you're out strolling in the park, and along comes someone walking a little chihuahua, and you point at that chihuahua and you say, "Doggy. That's a doggy." And your little niece smiles and goes, "Oh, you know, wants a pet, blah, blah, blah." You keep going. You're walking along, and along comes someone else, another family, and they're walking their what? German Shepherd. And you point to the German Shepherd, and you tell your niece, "Doggy, doggy." Now, think about that. To a 2 or 3 year old, the physical appearance of that instance or occasion of one chihuahua looks very different. It has very different many different characteristics than a full-grown German Shepherd.
Right.
But when we're pointing out and saying "doggy," we're not pointing specifically at the animal's size or coloration or hair, but rather it's a certain. It belongs to a. It has a certain kind of nature, namely dogness.
Right.
Right. The Chihuahua, the Lab, the Labradoodle, even, which is a kind of an invention of human, you know, the splicing. But you're pointing to, we're pointing out that these things have nature. So we're trying to teach the toddler that there is a universal concept, namely dog, of which is a concept, of which in the real world, there are particular instances of them of great variety, but nevertheless, all belong to dog.
And we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. We are in the Catholic Cave.
Or I think.
I think, or what looks like the Catholic Cave, or what might actually just be a radio studio. We're not sure. But we are talking about skepticism, and we are talking about the veracity of our senses. And we've gone through sort of the long, tawdry history of skeptical thought, and now we're talking a little bit about the antidote to it. How it is that we can know that what we're seeing, what we're perceiving actually is, actually has existence outside of our heads. So we were talking about the logical process of apprehension, of taking a concept from what we're perceiving with our senses. And the reason we're bringing this up is because in a lot of ways, that's where Hume's error really lies.
Yes. So I think left off is, for going all the way back to, say, Plato, and actually kind of where we got the name for the program, Catholic Cave, if you go back to the allegory of Plato's cave, the short version is, you come out of the cave into the light of the realm of the divine ideas where universal concepts are. And so, as we were saying, any of us can think of any particular dog, maybe the dog we have at home, but they all belong to what the species of dog. They all have dog, the nature of a dog. That nature or essential form makes them a dog and not something else. And so as we learn different animals, as example, we begin to come in contact with what we mean by a universal concept. Now, there are other ones, and it's for Plato, and I would say for us today, it's once we have a grasp of the universal concept of things that we then have true knowledge. When I begin to, even as that toddler makes the connect, when I finally make that connection between seeing a chihuahua, a chocolate lab, and a German shepherd, when I see that they all share in the same common nature of dogness, that's when I know what a dog is.
Right, and that's what allows you to learn more about what a dog is as well. So you expand and you add on to that concept of dog, and so you learn that dogs eat dog food, they don't eat people, and so you learn that you don't need to necessarily be afraid of yeah, dogs.
Right.
And you learn that, you know, dogs need a certain amount, they need walks, they need
companionship. Sort of yeah.
The dogs generally live with people, and you learn that, you know, they're closely related to wolves, which don't have those characteristics. And so you learn that if you're out walking and you see something that's furry with pointy ears and a nose,
maybe a little bigger than
maybe
the
a little bigger
than your poodle,
that might actually be a wolf and not a dog. And so you add and you expand your concept, and that's how knowledge takes place. That's how learning takes place, at the conceptual level. Well, for Hume, his understanding of ideas stopped at that mental image. He never really got a grasp of the idea of taking a universal concept, or he was skeptical of that process, right, at least. And so for him, all learning took place at the level of sense experience. It wasn't that you were learning and putting things together to create expanded concepts that we could then use, but we were our experience was really kind of limited to the realm of sensation.
Yeah, the particular instance. I think where that, but let me see if I can make a quick connection for everyone. I think where this eventually leads down to a breakdown of morality is this. Once you, if you can validate or verify or see that things have that there are universal concepts. The universal concept serves as the ideal, the perfect exemplar of the thing that it is. So the concept of a triangle, for example, a three-sided object whose interior angles equal 180 degrees, think about that. That's in your, the concept is a perfect triangle. Now take out a pen and paper and draw a triangle. Well, even if you're a good artist, you're going to notice that the your particular instance of that triangle is going to be less, the lines will be a little wavy, blah, 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 right? And so when we think of, once we have universal concepts, it allows us to move where Hume said we couldn't go, which is from the is to the ought. So Hume says, look around. That's the way things are. That's what it is. And he denied that we could go to ought. The word ought means that we're looking at a particular instance and it's lacking. It's lacking. It's deficient in some way. It's less than the perfect or the ideal of it. Well, what holds that image for us? That it's the concept of it. So think of a tree. You can look at any one tree out your window right now, your backyard, wherever you're at, and you can see that the tree is, it might be a good instance of a tree, but it's not a perfect tree. Right. It's the concept of tree that sets for the ideal. So in the area of morality for Hume, things are just mere custom because everything's just sort of an example of what is going on. There's no appeal to what ought to be. And morality, to have objective morality, you have to have a set of principles or universal concepts of what ought to be. And that's where he fails.
Right. And that lack of understanding of universal concepts for Hume is also what leads him to doubt the idea of causation. That yes. You can know that one thing is going to cause another thing because that has to do with the universal nature of things. Things cause things because of the things that they are. That's what we get from kind of the scholastic tradition. So the modern position is there's forces and things. Not that we deny that those exist. Those obviously exist. Gravity, they exist. But we can know because there's a universal concept informing these things, we can know with certainty how they're going to act to a certain extent because that's the nature of the thing. And we can study that. You know, just because we know that there's a nature to something doesn't mean we necessarily know what that nature is. We can know that there's a nature, but it's a process of learning, of exploration. Anybody that studied dogs will tell you they don't know everything there is to know, not even close, about how a dog works, what a dog thinks, how a dog acts. They're very unpredictable because we don't know. And so the process of exploring the concepts lead us to a better understanding of what causes what, but it also leads us to knowing that there is true causation. And because Hume didn't really have that understanding of a concept, he kind of, for him, ideas were those pictures that you create in your head. They were the mental images. And because of that, he was never really able to come up with an adequate theory of causation.
Well, and I think, too, someone I know near and dear to your heart and mine is, I want to bring up Professor Mortimer Adler, right, sort of the founder of the Great Books programs. Now, through that, the reason why I bring this up is when you read the Great Books, as that project team has laid that out, they felt they discovered, recognized that in this great tradition of the Western world, there were 102 great ideas. All of those great ideas, to a certain extent, are kind of universal concepts, and they're spheres in and of themselves for the mind or the intellect to explore, just like you said. So what are those things? Well, they're these great ideas, great meaning significant, right? Not necessarily great as I approve of, because one of them is tyranny, right? It's kind of, right? We don't approve of tyranny. Right. But tyranny is the kind of concept that your mind can explore, but other things like what? Justice, truth, beauty. These are all spheres of which the mind can inquire from. And beauty is neither true or false, but rather there are propositions about beauty that are true or false that we can discover,
right?
As you mentioned.
And I think this is where, I mean, I think you can kind of do a quick gut check about Hume's initial things that, you know, an idea is a mental image that you create in your head. You know, we all have the concept of beauty, right? But try to picture beauty in your head. it doesn't work out so well.
Right.
And so,
just beauty.
Right, exactly.
Not something beautiful, but just beauty. Beauty itself.
Exactly. But right. But yet, you'd have to be a very, very strong skeptic to doubt the existence of beauty.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I know we're going to run out of time here before too long, but just maybe bring it around one more time is that, you know, as Catholics, we believe for good reasons. It's not blind faith at all. We believe for good reasons that actually the data that we receive from our senses being sight, sound, hearing, smell, taste, these things are reliable, especially for the philosopher. The primary is really sight because you take in so much with sight that our vision, that is, we are apprehending through our senses the an act of the intellect of apprehension. We are grasping real objects in a real external world. So the Catholic Christian position is one of what we would call realism. Isn't that right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's not to say that we don't make mistakes. It's not to say that there aren't times when we're walking down the street and we start running the other way because we see what we think was a wolf and it turns out really to have been a dog.
Yeah. Mirages can happen.
Exactly.
Your senses can be fooled.
Right.
Dreams can come across while you're dreaming to have a certain, you know, real feel to them, you know, kind of. But at the end of the day, though, we're going to assert for good reasons that there's an external world that constitutes reality, and that our senses give us reliable sense data about it from which we can act and apprehend the world around us and understand and know things.
And that ability to know things is grounded in the fact that there are true things out there, but that those things have natures to them. They have a certain quality about them that allows them to be universals, that allow us to explore them and learn more about them and teach other people about them.
Yeah, there has to be, so taking human beings, right? We say we have a human nature, right? The one thing you and I and everyone listening have is we all belong to the same human family. Is that because we have the same hair color? Is that because we belong to the same race? No, gender? No. It's we all share in one what? Human nature.
Right.
We all belong to the same human family.
And we can have a sense of what's best for humans then. We can correct. Say what is good and what is bad and how people ought to act and how people ought not to act.
Right. We have them because we have human nature. There we also have what? These natural inclinations or desires. We experience hunger for what? Food. For food provides nourishment, and we know that there's good food, things that are better for us to eat and other things for us to avoid. And so that's going to take us into a whole nother show, because that's really what natural law theory is all built around. That.
Right, right. The understanding of a universal human nature that we all share in, and so therefore we can all really say what is good and what's bad and what's best and what's not.
Well, guys, that's about all the time we're going to have for today, because I just need to step in and take a little housekeeping time here. First of all, this past week we had the annual Catholic Radio Indy dinner. We'd really, really like to thank everyone who was there. Both you guys that were there that night.
It was great.
Fantastic night. It was a
wonderful
lot of fun.
Evening. Folks up the Northside KFC did a wonderful job of taking care of us. Father John Hollowell delivered a beautiful address for the evening. And we did manage to raise some funds to help keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. And in kind of wrapping up the show, I'd like to just ask a favor of everyone, because if you look at this past week, the past couple weeks, there have been a lot of things in the news that have drawn our attention, and some things that have fallen back to the back burner that we really didn't notice. I mean, we've been so preoccupied with Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma that, you know, maybe we missed the wildfires out in the West, or maybe we missed the earthquake in Mexico or flooding in Europe and Asia. The one constant in all these disasters is Catholic Relief Services. So we would ask, if you can, pray for all these situations. Pray for all the people who are involved in this, involved in the rescue efforts, involved in all the rebuilding that's going to have to take place now. But if you can, go out on the net, look up Catholic Relief Services, contribute if you can to help support these people who are out there on the front lines doing the good work and doing those corporal works of mercy that we need to see happen in this case. That is indeed all the time we have for the Catholic Cave this week. I'd like to thank you all for listening in. We'll be back next week. That's it for today. Until next time, may God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.